Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So it's confrontation time this week in Washington. Congressional Democrats casting votes on Iraq war funding with pullout dates attached, authorizing subpoenas for top White House officials, including Karl Rove, in the U.S. attorney's inquiry, lining up, at least rhetorically, with Al Gore on warnings of a planetary emergency on climate. Republicans drawing some lines, breaking some ranks. We've got John Edwards staying in the campaign as his wife Elizabeth confronts cancer again. A pet food scare, the UN Secretary General takes a near-miss mortar round in Baghdad. Up next on Point, we'll dig into a lively week in the news with top analysts Jack Beatty and you. We've got a great gang with us today to take on the headlines from Washington. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and a longtime George W. Bush watcher. Richard Wolff, great to have you back with us on Point.
Good to be with you.
From New York, Paul Keel joins us. He's deputy editor of the online news and comment powerhouse Talking Points Memo and a reporter and blogger for TPMMuckraker.com. He's been following the case of the fired U.S. attorneys from the beginning. Paul Keel, very good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty should join us in just a moment here, but Richard Wolff, let's just dive in from the top with the president at the end of this week on, first of all, the subpoena front. We've heard the arguments back and forth, the president laying down the line. Where is this headed? Constitutional crisis, or do you see a compromise in the works?
Well, it's certainly a knockdown political fight here. Both sides have dug themselves in very deeply, and a classic George Bush here. His own longtime friend, loyal ally, Alberto Gonzalez, is in a deep, deep hole. Everybody knows it. Inside the White House, all their allies on Capitol Hill, the more people push for him to go, the more President Bush will dig in and say, well, okay, maybe he's got to go, but at some point, on my terms, at my at the time of my choosing. And I think that's the dynamic we're in right now. So the Democrats can subpoena all they like. They're not going to get it. The Democrats really know that. And if the White House was serious about a compromise, it could have easily set up a blue ribbon panel, a special counsel, anyone outside to investigate this. They didn't go down that route because this is a fight they want to have. They want to make the Democrats look like they're overreaching.
They want to have the fight. We heard President Bush at the top of the hour saying, no, let's listen to a moment to Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, rejecting the offer of a private meeting, no transcript, no swearing in with top White House officials. Committee ultimately went to subpoenas to say they're ready to summon top officials, though it hasn't happened yet, to testify under oath about the eight U.S. attorneys fired.
The president said there'd have to be whatever testimony there was, it would have to be limited, one time only, behind closed doors, no transcript, limited number of people there. That is not what the American people want. I have suggested there be a regular hearing where both Republicans and Democrats ask questions. Under oath, the American public make up their mind.
Paul Keel, how do you see this unwinding here? Arlen Specter says, well, I've got a compromise position, maybe somewhere between the two. Does anybody want to reach for that, or do both sides want the showdown?
Well, at this point, the state of play is both the House and the Senate have subpoenas, you know, at the ready. The committees have voted to authorize the issuance of them. They haven't been issued yet. And what's going to happen over the next week or so is they're going to sit down again now that the terms of the conflict have been very clear. And they're going to see if there's any room for compromise. From the Democrats' standpoint, I think they might be willing to compromise, for instance, the idea of having an open hearing if in exchange they're willing, you know, they're able to get Karl Rove under oath or have a transcript at least of the proceeding. So both sides, I think the Democrats want to avoid going the whole 100 yards with the conflict, which would end up being a tangle in the courts, would take forever and wouldn't lead to any resolution of the questions that they're asking in the short term. It would be a marvelous mess to behold. That's for sure. And there's not really a roadmap for where this would go if it went to that.
I mean, history says ultimately people find compromises, but the compromise is not yet clear here. Richard Wolff, do you see at this point, where do you see the leverage in this lying and the political advantage in this lying?
Well, you're right to point out this is a political fight and it's being played out in political terms. The next beat of this is really the testimony of Kyle Sampson, former chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez. If anybody knows where the bodies are buried, it's him. And what he says, how what he says affects the credibility and the tenure of Alberto Gonzalez is going to be critical here, because that's the leverage that the Democrats have in terms of wringing out more concessions. Nobody's talking about this as being really seriously a case of criminal wrongdoing. It's a political fight. It's a question over whether Gonzalez can survive and how many political points Democrats or the White House can score here.
Jack Beatty, I think you're there now, and I'm glad you've joined us. Yes. How do you read this? At the end of this week, we've heard a lot about the arguments on both sides. President Bush says he won't be pushed. Patrick Leahy and others say we've got to have testimony on the record, and why not? Americans may be asking, if you're going to testify, why not take the oath? Do you have something to hide? But how does this wash at the end of the week as we look forward?
Well, you're right about taking oath. I mean, I've seen one figure that something like 144 different people from the Clinton administration took oaths and testified. But I think this the momentum of this story is going to be recharged if there is not forward movement on White House people testifying, because the Justice Department is going to leak. The professionals in that department are going to leak about political interference. Already we have found just the other day that there was political interference in a action against multi-billion-dollar action against the cigarette companies. That's come out now. We learned on NPR yesterday that there was political interference continually in the Civil Rights Division. And these leaks are coming from the pros, the people who really honor justice within this department and who feel that under Gonzalez they have become an arm of the White House.
Paul Keel, your outfit, Talking Points Memo, has really followed closely all the backstory, the attorney's uproar here. Is there something to be leaked? Richard Wolff says this isn't criminal. Well, it's certainly very political, and there's issues of precedent here and balance of power. No doubt, but is there more to be leaked here?
You mean with respect to the White House?
With respect to the stories behind these attorney firings.
Well, what you have right now is you have 3,000 pages of emails that the Justice Department have put out there, and what the emails show is that there was no significant deliberative process before the firing of these prosecutors, and what I mean by that is, you know, what you would expect from a department full of lawyers is lots of memos like, hey, we have a problem with this U.S. attorney. He's not doing X and Y. Let's talk to him about it. And then the next memo is, we talked to him about it. Here's what he said. He's not cooperating. We should maybe look forward to, you know, removing him in like 6 months of that.
But you don't see investigations that some of these attorneys, U.S. attorneys, may have been involved in that the White House would not want them involved in. Were they getting into areas that would have been unwelcome for the Republican Party, for President Bush to see them pursue? Is it that kind of thing or not?
Well, there's one clear case that pretty much was the reason that my website got so energized by the story, and it's the case of Carol Lam, who investigated the Duke Cunningham case. But the Duke Cunningham case is a bribery case that is much more sprawling than just one member of Congress. It has led to the indictment of the executive director of the CIA. It has led to the investigation of another very powerful Republican member of Congress, Jerry Lewis. And there's indications that it could lead to at least another couple of members of Congress. Whether it reaches into the White House or not is a question that sort of, I think, narrows it too much, because it's the White House is concerned not just about the White House, but about, you know, the health of the Republican Party as a whole. I think a point that should be made here is the White House has already admitted that they are interested in the fact that certain U.S. attorneys did not prosecute certain what they call voter fraud cases, which are specifically cases of Democratic wrongdoing and getting people on the voter rolls. In the case of U.S. Attorney David Iglesias in New Mexico and another one in Washington, these were U.S. attorneys who looked very seriously into these cases and decided that reasonable doubt wasn't there. It wasn't a prosecute. They couldn't prosecute the case. But there were powerful Republicans in the states who were going to the White House, and Bush has admitted, you know, passing along complaints to the Justice Department. And it looks, since there's no very good reason in all these documents that the Justice Department has released, people are pointing to that as the only reason that makes any sense for why these guys were fired.
So, Richard Wolff, if I may ask you, what about Republicans on the issue of Alberto Gonzalez, the president saying this week he's going to stand by him, though at the beginning of the week many thought he would soon be gone? Conservative columnist David Brooks saying senior people in the Justice Department had no coherent sense of honor. Are there Republicans who wish Gonzalez was just out and out of the way, or do they fear that if he goes, you know, it's open season?
Oh, no, there are many congressional Republicans who want him gone. I think the consensus among congressional Republicans is very clear. I was speaking to one, Adam Putnam, who's a member of the House leadership, who was very clear at saying that Gonzalez has lost credibility. And also, you've got to look at the history of this. There are many Republicans who went out there who staunchly defended Donald Rumsfeld before the last election, only to find out the White House was plotting for him to be pushed out. So there's a lingering bitterness about that.
Jack, lots going on in the Senate and in the House on Iraq funding, all kinds of action there. As we speak at this moment, still not a vote from the House, but likely to come soon. It looks like it may be eked out in the end. What do you make of the Democrats back and forth within their own ranks trying to come to conclusions on funding legislation?
Well, their blue dog or conservative Democrats don't like the timeline here to bring the troops home by September 1. Many of them, in fact, although they ran against the war or critical of the administration, they didn't want any date certain. So they're going to lose some of those votes. The Democrats only have 15 seats really to play with here. And then on the other side, liberals didn't want to vote for it because it was an appropriations bill. And John Lewis said, I'm just through with that. I'm not voting to pay another cent for this. But just overnight, apparently, enough liberals have come forward and said they're going to vote for this, that it looks like it's going to pass by three or four votes. And effectively, it would set a benchmarks that would require the president to report about the state of Sunni and Shiite extremists in July, about reducing sectarian violence, about the oil revenues. There'd be other reports in October. And if the Iraqi government didn't meet these benchmarks, the pullout of troops would begin earlier than the September 1, 2008.
Richard Wolff, is this another example of a vote that may have no traction? Does it go anywhere? Is it certain to be vetoed? Is this political posturing?
Yes. total posturing and important posturing, though. I mean, this is important for it's not just because of the subject, because it's about the war, but also this is a real test of everyone's focused on Democratic cohesion here, but it's also about how Democrats in the majority deal with a very vocal, very active base that has really found its voice through the internet, organized itself very effectively. They've got to show that they are going that extra mile and trying hard to affect the course of the war, where, in fact, they stand absolutely no chance of affecting the course of the war, not just because the president is threatening a veto and because he's the commander-in-chief, but because this legislation, this kind of legislation, will never get through the Senate. It will be filibustered. Democrats don't have enough votes to overcome that filibuster, so it is, as they say, dead on arrival. It is token gesture, but it's an important token, and it says more about, I think, Democratic politics than the future conduct of the war.
We've got Ohio Congressman, Democratic presidential hopeful again, Dennis Kucinich, saying that more money for the war is the wrong way to end it.
Instead of true accountability on the war, the president and the vice president could get over $100 billion to keep the war going through the end of their term. More war, more civilian deaths, more soldiers killed or maimed. Less money for housing, for health care, for education, for seniors.
There's Kucinich. Of course, Republicans shot back. This is not the way to run a war, and yet many watch it go on and go on. These supplementals, Paul Keel, kind of not part of the regular budget, but this time we've got all kinds of stuff breaking into the numbers. $3.7 billion in here in the House Democrats' version for farm interest, $74 billion for peanut farmers, $252 billion for milk subsidies. Congressman David Obey saying out there, I represent dairy farmers. You got a problem with that? Wow, we're in new territory here where the Iraq War funding is also funding agricultural stuff at home.
I don't know that it's completely new territory because I think it was a pretty common practice. I don't know necessarily for war supplementals, but Congress has a long history of tacking on unrelated things to legislation such as appropriations.
But here we are off the books. This isn't part of the regular budget process, right? This is a special process for Iraq and for Afghanistan.
Right. It's a special process that, by the way, is a favored process by the White House because it has a way of sort of fudging the overall numbers when the budget's delivered every year. I would make the larger point that, Democrats campaigned against this sort of thing. But on the other hand, it's sort of a Washington business as usual type thing. Although, I would admittedly a particularly galling example of it.
Yes, Jack.
It should be pointed out there's a lot in here, too, for veterans' hospitals, for veterans' recovery, for aiding the troops when they come home and for equipping them properly. So it's not all just pork barrel to bring in a few votes. Mm.
Both sides on that ledger. And then, of course, we've got this amazing news today. 15 British soldiers apparently picked up by Iranians. That after we had shells falling near the U.N. Secretary General in the Green Zone, or a shell, in Baghdad, an attempt on the life by a suicide bomber in the security contingent of the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Richard Wolff. This is getting very close to the core.
Yes, although I thought it was quite remarkable that when Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, ducked, the man standing next to him, the Iraqi Prime Minister, didn't flinch.
But what do you make of that? Dead man walking or just a brave man inured to... I mean, you don't flinch when a mortar falls 80 yards away?
Right, this is a man who has come under shellfire at his home and certainly in the... This is the Green Zone. I can't tell you how many layers of concrete there are you have to fly over to get into it or drive through. Yes, Iraq is still in a perilous state, even as people are talking about the beginnings of the signs of progress with this new general in charge, Petraeus, and the extra troops going in. But it's very fragile. And look, as for the Iranian situation, the British and an American strategy has been to squeeze the Iranian regime to use gunboat diplomacy, more gunboats than diplomacy, really. And you are going to have this kind of confrontation as you try and undermine a regime and bring them to the negotiating table on your terms. It's going to happen. I expect it to be resolved peacefully, but... Who knows? These are just first reports that are coming in right now.
We've got Al Gore and John Edwards to look at, but let's turn to our callers. Mark is calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks. What do you know?
Good. I just wanted to congratulate Paul Keel and Talking Points Memo for doing a superb job bringing this U.S. attorney story together.
They've really been on it. Another one of these examples of where sometimes the blogosphere ends up driving mainstream news. What do you see now, Mark?
Well, I think the contrast with the mainstream media is drawn out by this. The mainstream media keeps talking about this as a political dispute and pointing out that the U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president, and they're really missing the boat. What this is a twofold concerted effort. One, to insulate political allies of the president. Two, to punish political adversaries. And what you're seeing is that this approach is now tracking very neatly with the three articles of impeachment in the Watergate case. The first article of impeachment was for obstruction of justice, and that's where protecting your political allies comes in. The second article was for abuse of power, and that's where punishing your political adversaries comes in. And the third article was for refusing to comply with congressional subpoenas, and that's what we're up against right now. And I think it's a real disservice and very myopic for the mainstream media to dismiss this as a political confrontation. What you really have is the perversion of the Justice Department for political purposes by the administration.
Richard Wolff, you're as close as mainstream media as we've got right now. What do you say to Marx?
As the spokesman for mainstream media, I think the outlines of this are still not clear. That's exactly why you need an inquiry, whether congressional or something with credibility on the outside. If this comes down to essentially obstruction of justice, which is the only criminal scenario you'd have out there, in other words, public corruption cases that the White House was trying to disrupt, then yes, this is a very serious story. We're not clear that that's where it's headed, although obviously the caller has his own thoughts. Some of these cases seem to be policy-driven, and there is a difference between policy and partisan politics. And in the cases that Paul was mentioning, David Iglesias in New Mexico, possibly Carol Lam in Southern California, there is an element of partisanship and public corruption cases which are get right into the heart of the partisan questions about the execution of justice. But we don't know the full extent because we haven't seen the evidence. We haven't seen people testify. That's exactly why you want to know more.
More things coming out, Jack. You mentioned yesterday Sharon Eubanks, longtime Justice Department attorney who was in the big tobacco suit, saying that they'd been pulled back at the last minute by political operatives in the department. Her quote there was, "The political people were pushing the buttons and ordering us to say what we said. And because of that, we failed to zealously represent the interests of the American public." Of course, she's retired now, and speaking from the outside, we'll see what we hear from the inside. Let's go to Oscar in Sandown, New Hampshire. Oscar, you're on the air.
Good day, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of points. On the Attorney General, at least, I mean, not the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney in New Mexico, when he was called up by the two congressmen.
David Iglesias,
Well, you know, it would seem to me that they can be served at for the pleasure of the president, but you can't fire somebody for doing his job or if asking to open the Congress, I believe the congresswoman asked the attorney to look into the investigation that he was doing. That, you know, that's just not kosher. If they have a problem with the U.S. attorney, they should have called his boss, the general attorney.
So what would you like to see now? Do you want to see Rove come down for a conversation or Rove under oath on Capitol Hill?
Well, I can remember when President Clinton was brought in front of a grand jury while he was sitting. And then I remember that grand jury testimony being broadcast across the world, which, from what I understood while I was watching it, grand jury testimony is supposed to be private, never supposed to be released. And I really didn't understand that there's not one American citizen that is above everybody else.
So a sitting and president there talking about his relationship with an intern. Well, that's Paul Keel. It's interesting. There you had the president himself on the stand.
I mean, the White House, Tony Snow started using this talking point yesterday that Congress actually has no oversight obligation over the White House, that everything the White House gives the Congress is out of, you know, the goodness out of the bottom of their heart, just sort of erasing, you know, decades of history of oversight. I mean, there is true that there is executive privilege, but the sort of interpretation that they're sounding publicly is a... There's somebody who described it as executive privilege on crack. It's like it's a maximalist. It's probably even an understatement to say it's a maximalist interpretation of what executive privilege means.
Hi and why, Jack? I hear you there, but just a moment. Let me get a call from Dubuque, Iowa. Paul, looks like we just lost Paul. Let's go to Rob in Plainfield, Connecticut. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. I've been a conservative all my life. I registered Republican when I turned 18 to vote for Bush's father, but I know a lot of conservatives. I don't know a single one that supports Bush or supports the war. Frankly, we think he should be tried for treason.
I certainly see conservatives who are still on the president's side here and still backing the war. Certainly in Congress, Rob, you've got to see those.
I mean, establishment conservatives, you know, not the people that I know on the ground who have been conservatives all their life. He really discredited our whole, you know, side of the spectrum for generations to come. If anything, we're more angry than liberals. I mean, 655,000 Iraqis dead. You know, that's a cause for outrage, you know, over a war for choice. I went to the anti-war protest last weekend, and I saw lots of bumper stickers on the way down, on the way up, against the war, impeach Bush, you know, and tens of thousands of people marching. it doesn't get much more clear than that. The country has turned against him. I don't care about the Congress critters.
There's a different tone of conservative complaint. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You know, Tom, that gets us to this fourth anniversary of the war, and I think it's worth remark. You know, Paul Fussell, in his fine book, The Great War and Modern Memory, which is about British poets in World War I, Fussell wrote that you can write the history of war as a history of flesh, of dismemberment, burns, burst intestines, damaged brains. And that text of the war, this war, is caught in the photograph of a legless veteran that's on the cover of Richard's magazine.
Newsweek.
Newsweek. And of soldiers like that, Siegfried Sassoon, the British war poet, wrote, "Pray that you may never know the hell where youth and laughter go." But, you know, you can also write the history of war as an answer to Lenin's question, who benefits? Who benefits from the damaged flesh? 4 years on, who's benefited in Iraq? And I think, you know, when you start to look at that bill, that's when the thing really seems grimmer than grim. I mean, at the head of the list has to be Iran. They had an enemy there in Saddam. They don't now. They have a friendly regime. We did it for them. Then, there, of course, there's Halliburton and its shareholders. There are the oil companies that are about to sign these production sharing agreements that will give them lots of profit out of that. And I think, you know, George Bush himself has been a beneficiary. I mean, if famously, Don Rumsfeld said, there aren't enough targets to bomb in Afghanistan. We need something else. Well, they got something else.
But George Bush, a beneficiary, his life doesn't look too pleasant just lately.
Not now. But you go back and look at that 2004 election. There was still majority support for this war. And the effect of this war was to change the subject. Change the subject from what we saw on September 11th, the blunders and the incompetence around that, to a new subject, the war in Iraq. And I really think you could actually see how the war helped get him reelected. So the flesh has paid and paid terribly, as our caller reminds us. And thus far, it seems to me, it's hard to make the case that anybody, except for these politicians and big interests, has benefited.
Richard Wolff, you've got the wounded vet on the cover of your magazine. What about the politics? Now, Tom Edsel writing this week that it's John McCain and Rudy Giuliani who are being most effective in pummeling the poor execution of the war. He's saying Democrats should stand up and do that more. Could it be that Republican contenders will end up somehow making hay out of the Iraq War more effectively than Democrats?
With great respect to Tom Edsel, who's a fabulous writer and reporter, I think he's completely wrong. It's not just my opinion. I speak to a number of Republican strategists, really successful, well-established people, who say this is a miserable election for Republicans to be in because of the war. Now, the White House fully expects to get beaten up by every Republican about the war, because that's all they can do. They still have to try and bridge the divide between people like the caller you just heard, Republicans who have turned against the war, and 50% of Republicans who still support the war, say they do in polls, and support the president. So very hard for Republicans to do this. Democrats have free rein. 80-90% support for their position against the war, against President Bush.
We're looking at a week in the news, from big Iraq funding debates to, of course, the U.S. attorney's story, cancer and a campaign with John Edwards and his wife, Elizabeth. Al Gore on Capitol Hill this week testifying about global warming.
America is the natural leader of the world, and our world faces a true planetary emergency.
A pet food emergency on other fronts, not to make light of Al, but lots of people wondering what their pets are eating.
To find out, they knew about this weeks ago, and that the cats they tested died. Why wasn't it pulled off then? Why do so many people have to suffer right now?
And then there's the YouTube bit on Hillary Clinton posed as a kind of a 1984 tyrant in the old Apple computer ad with her face superimposed. The story behind that.
1 month ago, I began a conversation with all of you, and so far, we haven't stopped talking, and that's really good. I intend to keep telling you exactly where I stand on all of the issues.
I'm looking at how to help you and other people who are hardworking.
The web comes into the 08 campaign. Paul Keel, you live online. What do you make of that? Somebody related to Barack Obama's campaign does a little, digital artistry. We've got 1.6 million at the last count I saw, viewers of this thing that paints Hillary Clinton as a kind of mind control, zombie chief. Is this kind of thing going to be wagging the 08 campaign?
Well, I'd make sort of a central point about that is I think on Talking Points Memo, we actually linked to that video, I would say, about 2.5 weeks ago or something like that.
So everybody else is behind what you guys once again. Okay, well, but it's out there.
That's it. No, but the point I was going to make about that is that what happened is that earlier this week it showed up on the Drudge Report. And there, it's always a short walk from there to Fox News and CNN. And once it got picked up there, it had a second life. So while the chosen media storyline for this is that, YouTube, democratization of political advertising and this and that, like this was broadcast by the mainstream media in a way that, far beyond, you have almost 2 million people have seen it on YouTube, but I doubt it would have come to this point if it hadn't been picked up by the mainstream media.
Well, they talk about it a lot. The number who actually show the whole thing is a different deal. Jack Beatty, what about, here's a way, the guy who did it said, look, I wanted to show that one citizen can stand up, but is this the online world reaching out to tweak politicians in ways they don't want to be tweaked? Is it rankly unfair to Hillary Clinton or picking up on some droning tone in her voice that makes her vulnerable?
I mean, I just think everything now is fair game. I mean, we saw George Allen in Virginia talking in a rural town, and he talked too freely. If there was somebody there taking a picture of it. So, in a way, Big Brother is watching everybody all the time now in these campaigns, and a slip of the tongue, or somebody's clever idea, and you can get in trouble real fast.
Let's listen to a little bit of Al Gore on Capitol Hill. Here, of course, he was talking a lot about the environment, but then you had this interesting exchange between Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who's called global warming a hoax, and Barbara Boxer, the U.S. Senator from California.
All right. I'm sure you read the New York article that quoted the scientist. I mentioned this in my opening statement about their criticizing you for some of your being too alarmist and hurting your own cause. Now, I'll ask you to respond in writing for that one, because that would be a very long response, I'm afraid. Now, it seems that global warming and the media joined the chorus last summer.
Excuse me, Senator Inhofe, we'll freeze the time for a minute.
Oh, yes.
I'm just trying to
take your time. We're freezing the time.
No, we're freezing the time. Just for a minute. I want to talk to you a minute, please. Would you agree to let the vice president answer your questions? And then if you want an extra few minutes at the end, I'm happy to give it to you. But we're not going to get anywhere.
Why don't we do this?
You're asking
good
questions.
Do this? At the end, you can have as much time as you want to answer all the questions.
No, that isn't the rule. You're not making the rules. You used to when you did this. You don't do this anymore. Elections have consequences.
Wow, here's a new world. Barbara Boxer waving the gavel under the nose of James Inhofe of Oklahoma, kind of spanking there, Richard Wolff. What did you make of the overall reception of Al Gore on the Hill?
Well, this is a man whose time has come. I mean, the politics of the environment have shifted, and not just because Inhofe is no longer the chairman of this committee, but you hear an increasing number of prominent Republicans who want to embrace environmental politics and want to do something about climate change. You're seeing it, obviously, in states like California, but also Republican presidential candidates, not the least of whom is Newt Gingrich, who has said that Republicans need to play catch-up. Al Gore, has found a voice here that he obviously didn't have in 2000. He's got a lot more respect for what he's been doing, not just because of his movie. And, that's the sort of backstory. The question is whether any of these earnest politicians who want to play catch up or feel passionately about it will actually do something, because that's clearly their responsibility now.
Let's hear a little more of Al Gore conveying what to this panel what he thought their grandchildren would be saying if there isn't action soon.
What in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence?
Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years, the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act?
Jack, are we taking a corner here? Or is the debate turning?
Well, you know, I think the dilemma that legislation and action on global warming faces was right there in that testimony. He was addressing John Dingell, the senior member of Congress, chairman of that committee, from Michigan. And, of course, just the other week, the auto companies and the United Auto Workers and, of course, the Michigan delegation came out against any change in CAFE standards with the requirement that they get the gas mileage
right
down. And increased. And so there's the problem right there. I mean, any kind of serious action runs into the roadblocks right within our political system.
But the big three also came out in favor of a carbon emissions cap, which would share the burden of it. But that was kind of amazing in itself. I mean, there's something turning here.
Something is turning, and you hear it from these companies that are coming forward and understanding they have to change. But I still think that to do something meaningful here, something along the lines of what Gore was talking about, we're going to need unfortunately, the environmental equivalent of September 11th, something that's just going to change the entire discussion.
Paul Keel, do you see Al Gore as having brought the whiff of that onto Capitol Hill this week?
I don't know if it's like an environmental 9/11. It's I'd make two points. One is with this emissions debate, Democrats sort of find themselves in the same predicament as they do with the Iraq debate, and that is, they're advocating a position that is generally has broad public support, but in terms of doing something meaningful about the subject, there's a lot of roadblocks in their way in terms of crafting legislation. And there's a second minor point I would make about that exchange between Boxer and Inhofe, mm-hmm. something I've seen a number of times in the last month. For example, Henry Waxman, who heads up the Government Reform Committee, it's basically like he's like the chief investigator mm-hmm. for House Democrats, sent a letter to Secretary Rice, and he was asking for questions about basically like the evidence for weapons of mass destruction leading up to the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And he said something like, you know, I'd ask you a number of questions while I was in the minority, and I only got answers to a few of them, but, I'm chairman of the committee now, so maybe you want to get back to me.
So the tension large and long there in the wake of November's election. Let's take a caller from Iowa City, Iowa. Martin, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just as I listened to the speak about the Republicans and the Democrats and the positions that they've taken historically with Clinton and the cases with Monica Lewinsky and that sort of thing, and now Bush, my question specifically is, and I'd be interested in the thoughts of the panel, when does this Congress and the government get back to running this country?
Well,
what will it take?
To running the country? Well, I mean, Richard Wolff, there is a crunching of gears here as they get used to having Democrats back in control on Capitol Hill. But do you see paralysis in all this in now the long run up to 08, or do you see preparation for running the country maybe in a little different direction?
No, I see paralysis, actually. Whatever hopes people had that people could work together or the two parties could work together has really dissipated quickly. Look at immigration reform, for instance, an area where there was actually a real area of common ground between the president and Democrats. He had more of a problem with his own party than with Democrats. That has now faded considerably because of presidential politics on the Republican side of things. He's lost John McCain, for instance, as a key ally there. This is where the White House wants to have this debate about U.S. attorneys. It's trying to say this is a distraction from the big things like war, like energy. You know, who would have known or predicted that the president, President Bush, with his incredibly tarnished environmental record, will be out there pushing alternative energy, higher CAFE standards, If the Democrats are serious about the environment, then they should move quickly. And these proposals have been out there for a couple of months. And, but Congress moves slowly, and it's moving particularly slowly because of these partisan tensions that are getting full vent right now.
And the president, are you saying happy to keep that underway? Or,
if this is their easy defense against the inquiries about the U.S. attorneys is to say, listen, there are bigger things out there. We should be dealing with the big subjects. We should be trying to run the country. They have a model here, by the way, for dealing with this kind of scandal, which was Clinton in the 1990s. Ironically, given the president came to power, President Bush came to power saying he wanted to clean things up. But the model here is that you can paint the other side as overreaching, as obsessing about the minutiae, about partisan attacks instead of the big stuff. It worked for Clinton then, and the White House is banking that it's going to work for them now.
Well, a big noise right on that point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut. And Tom, hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
We're good. What do you see, Tom?
Thanks. Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm calling about the issue of the attorney scandal, the U.S. attorney scandal, and the way it's being portrayed. In some ways, following up on what an earlier caller said, I think it's very important to not put this in terms of pure politics. I'm a veteran in a certain sense of the culture wars going back to the late 80s, and the great conservative complaint then against liberals was that they were rendering the pursuit of truth impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, insofar as you bring up and portray these things, and it's clear the White House in Bush's speech the other day was trying to portray these things in political terms, you're putting it into the great realm of gray things,
mm-hmm.
gray things that have no pure principled truth to them.
Mm-hmm.
And insofar as our media continues to portray it, as I think Mr. Wolf did earlier in the show, as something that's a matter of grayness, a matter of advantage, a matter of who's up and who's down and what you can get, you're playing right into the White House's hands, and the overwhelming irony of all that is that it's the conservatives who, with the complicity of the mainstream media, have really begun to make hay out of the very things they decried back in the culture wars. Make it gray, make it so that nothing sticks, make it all relative. And in fact, there's very real historical, constitutional issues going on that many of us want addressed.
Tom, you're cutting some pretty clear ice there. Richard Wolf, what about it? Are you touched with the Tony Snow gray stick here?
No, the grayness I was talking about is not the moral, philosophical questions that the caller is talking about. It's that we don't know.
Well, constitutional questions, even more concrete than moral and philosophical.
Yeah, but my point about grayness is that we don't know the scope of what happened and why it happened. That's why people need to testify, why we need to know more. And as a journalist, look, you can, as a political partisan figure, you can make any case you want. But as a journalist, you want to know what the facts are. I still think we don't know the full facts of the story. That's exactly why Congress is trying to get this information. But to suggest that that somehow makes me complicit with the White House, I totally reject.
Paul Keel, do you see a path out there? The president's not going to, you know, go for the subpoenas, everyone's saying today. Is there a path by which the facts, maybe it's the leaking path Jack Beatty describes, at which the facts fully and completely come out, not in private conversations, but in a public way that leads to a kind of path of accountability in this whole U.S. attorney business?
Well, like I said earlier, I think the Democrats are willing to give on certain things. Like, I think they don't want to be told what they can ask about. They don't want to be told who can be in the room. I think they're perhaps prepared to surrender having an open hearing. They might even be willing to surrender the oath aspect if they can have a transcript, because it is true that making statements to Senate investigators, you can be prosecuted for false statements. So I think that there is actually a room for compromise, because from the perspective of Democrats who are investigating this, if they want to get the facts, you know, obviously they can't settle for a White House offer, which is inadequate. But if it leads to a court battle that would probably take months and months, if not years, it's a really hard call for them.
Jack Beatty, you hear the frustration in that caller's voice, looking for accountability here, not wanting this to float off into anything like a sea of gray, wanting it on quite the opposite, clarified.
Clarified, indeed. A very eloquent statement, and it gets back to our first caller with what I thought was a brilliant parallel to the charges in the Watergate impeachment. Because what's involved here, and the evidence that we know, and there may be exculpatory evidence on all these things, but the evidence we know points to an effort on the one hand by the Justice Department to use the U.S. attorneys to go hard on Democratic corruption. And in fact, there are statistics that show there have been disproportionate prosecutions of Democrats. And two, to go easy on Republicans or to back off from those investigations. That is corrupting the coin of justice. That you can't get anything more basic in our system than that. And, you know, we're going to start to see a lot of appeals of cases where people have been convicted by these U.S. attorneys because they're going to point to this evidence and say, hey, I was dragooned up here on a political charge. And they're going to have things to point to indicate they were.
Meanwhile, watch for the leaks, and we'll watch how it unfolds. I want to thank each of you for being with us this hour. Paul Keel at Talking Points Memo in New York. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff, Senior White House Correspondent for Newsweek Magazine. Richard, thanks for helping us wrap up the week.
Anytime.
And Jack Beatty, always good to have you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.